This is the No Dabble Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Andy Gokey, lead of the native AOT and app model team at Microsoft. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Andy.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, so I've been at Microsoft for about 10 years now. I joined right out of school. I did some work in programming languages back in college, and then I managed to find a job at Microsoft working on programming languages, which was fantastic. So I joined the C# compiler team, where I was an engineer on that team for 8 years. And then I decided to move to a dev lead position, and I moved down. So I moved from the compiler team down to the runtime to work more on the nitty gritty of things. And now I'm the lead of the native AOT app model. So we do native AOT compilation for the CLR, as well as trimming, assembly loading, kind of the front end of the runtime in some sense.
Tonight we're going to talk about AOT, but I want to get a very brief overview of it first, and then we're going to kind of wind our way back to other types of compilation. So can you kind of just give us a quick, what is AOT?
Yeah, so AOT stands for ahead of time. And mostly it's named that because it's in contrast with our conventional offering for C#, which is JIT, just in time. And the entire idea with JIT is that you end up compiling your code, but it compiles mostly at runtime. When the actual application is running, that's when the CLR, the Common Language Runtime, will actually compile your code. AOT is in contrast to that. We try to find all of the code ahead of time and compile your whole application to native assembly ahead of time before you ever run a line.
When you say find it, what do you mean?
So most of the time, your code is not just the actual code that you write. It's the code you write, the framework that you depend on, so the .NET framework, .NET 7, .NET 6, et cetera, and then all of your libraries. So what we do is what's called like a self-contained build. And the idea is that the SDK gathers everything together, all of the code that will go into your application, and it collects it and then passes it to the IL compiler. And then the IL compiler does its job of taking all of the IL, including the IL for the runtime, all the native bits that we need for the runtime, and shoving it all into one application and compiling it all the way down to assembly.
Okay, so we're going to stop with AOT for a little while and go back to earlier times in programming, but they're still perfectly applicable. What is traditional compilation? So languages like C and C++.
Yeah, so for the academic view, so my academic history will tell you that there's a very simple explanation for what's compiled and what's interpreted, and that we really are just talking about a spectrum here. So an interpreter is something which takes in code and then executes it. It directly executes the code. So if you think about a line of code like print, an interpreter will see the print line and it will execute the print function. A compiler is a translator. It doesn't actually run anything. It doesn't execute anything. It takes in code. It sees a print function. It sees a print function in whatever language you're running. And it translates it into what should be the identical functionality in its target language. So conventional compilers like C take print functions that come from C and compile into assembly language that is the equivalent of the C, and then hand it off. And you might know the most important interpreter is your CPU. The CPU takes machine instructions and it interprets them into execution.
Then if you compile, let's say, down to the machine instruction, does that require that the compiler is suited for that architecture, whether it's x86 or ARM or something else?
Right. As a compiler, as a translator, it always has to understand both the source language and the target language. And at the highest possible level, when we think about languages, we think about defined behavior. And so if you're a C compiler, then you are supposed to understand that the language C has particular behavior. And then the target language, assembly, has to have that has similar behavior, and you map one to the other. And so the goal is to have a 100% accurate mapping that is as fast as possible.
And then operating systems too, though, because I mean, in our world of modern .NET, I can take my code, I can run it on any of the operating systems. But back in my days of C, if I was compiling on Windows, I got a .exe, and if I was compiling on Unix, I got something else. So where does the operating system come into compilation?
Right. So that's a great point. And so one of the kind of fundamental ideas of this abstract notion of compilation and translation is, well, what if you move higher up the stack? What if our target language isn't, let's say, x86 assembly running on a Linux machine? What if it's this other language, which we call .NET IL? Well, .NET IL doesn't have to have behavior that's specified in terms of its underlying machine. It can have its own behavior. And then you can compile from your target language, like C Sharp, into .NET IL. And the job of a runtime or an interpreter, another compiler, whatever, is to take that .NET IL and port it to whichever machine you're targeting. So effectively, by combining more compilers and interpreters, you can make certain stages more portable than they were before.
When you were talking about interpreters, and if we moved, let's say, from languages like C and C++, if you move into Bash, Awk, JavaScript, Node, what's different about them when you compare them to C? And does interpretation come into those ones too?
Yeah, so most languages are now a hybrid of compilation and interpretation. So you might ask, you know, why would you pick an interpreter over a compiler or vice versa? As I mentioned, at the most fundamental level, you have your CPU, which is executing instructions, as an interpreter. So you always have to have an interpreter somewhere, because execution has to actually happen for your program to run. So the question is, why would you use compilation? Because interpretation, you kind of always have to use. And the reason is usually performance, that the target language has some improved performance in some sense. In our case, it's usually that, well, the CPU understands assembly instructions, and therefore we need to feed it assembly instructions. We could interpret the code ourselves and feed the assembly instructions to the compiler. That way, we could effectively interpret into assembly language. But sometimes that's slow. So a compiler can make that whole process faster. And so Python, C, they balance back and forth, but it's usually about performance and it's about compatibility.
But then in the mid-90s, late 90s, Java came out, and then shortly afterwards, C#. And we got away from the compilation you were talking about with C and C++, and sort of the interpreted script languages like Awk and Sed and Bash, as they were. I don't think JavaScript was such a thing back then. But what was the point of making Java and C compile in a significantly different way than what came before?
Yeah, so they brought in JIT compilation, which that's just-in-time compilation, the idea that that you don't compile ahead of time like C would be. You instead compile basically when your method runs, effectively when right before you actually need to compile or before you execute. So you could interpret, but the problem is that interpretation is sometimes slow. A lot of the times you might find that you are interpreting the same code over and over again, and the interpretation process of that code is slow. And if you wanted to, you could try and figure something out and make a faster version by compiling it. And so the JIT compiler from Java, the JIT compiler from .NET, both of them were trying to kind of hit the same target, which is, what if we try to do something more, like, basically more dynamic, so it's kind of like Python, it has Python awk said, it has some of that flexibility, but at the same time, we keep some of the compilation so that we can have the highest possible performance. So that's where the bar moves back and forth, that you kind of don't have to do this somewhat heavy ahead of time compile step. You improve your portability sometimes because you're not compiling all the way down to assembly. But at the same time, you still want to compile a little bit to get the highest performance.
With Java, I remember when I was in university, I was working on projects in Java, and you know, it worked fine on my Windows NT, I think it was back then. And it also worked on, I can't remember whether it was a Linux or a Sun station I was using, but I had the exact same code and it was working on both. So from the perspective of Java, that made sense. You know, they were happy to be in the Unix world, they're happy to be in the Windows world. But when C Sharp came out, that was Microsoft very much Windows only. Where was the portability benefit for Microsoft and C Sharp by doing this extra work?
Yeah. So I have to admit, I wasn't there at the time. That's about 20 years old now. So I hadn't even graduated from college yet. I hadn't graduated from high school yet. At that point, I think the benefit would have been sold primarily as, first of all, it would have been multiple architectures. That flexibility still exists. So Windows now runs on, there's AMD 64, X64, 64-bit. But at the same time, there's also x86. And if you go back a little bit further, back when 64-bit computing was kind of getting started, there was still this general question of, is x86 going to be the thing that we launch into the future with? And there was a thing called Itanium. And so people were still thinking about that. It turned out not to really be that big of a thing, but it was a thing. And then the extra benefits effectively came from dynamism, that you could, in fact, do things like load plugins at runtime. And you could load a plugin from disk, and because it was .NET IL, you could move it from machine to machine. You wouldn't have to recompile it. You wouldn't have to kind of prep it every time. It would just be cheap, and it would be loaded on demand.
So yeah, so the third-party libraries could be brought down, and you'd be guaranteed they would work, whether it was my Spark or your Windows or whatever happened. Well, in the case of C Sharp, not Spark, but yeah, the different processor architectures. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Right. And also just some of the benefits of IL that have maybe not stayed with us as much. There used to be this thing called code access security and Silverlight and these kind of broad-based attempts to do more at the IL level. In general, though, I'd say that the biggest one is that the IL presents a lingua franca. It attempts to create this object language, this type system, that is portable from machine to machine, language to language. And by having that, you can effectively talk at a higher level than just machine code. And that's basically what C++ and those kinds of languages offered you.
Bringing the clock back to the more recent times, so pre-.NET 7 and AOT, there were features ready to run and trimming. Can you explain those and what they do?
Right. So my team also owns trimming. And I will get into it, but trimming is actually super important for native AOT as a whole. But ready to run is really interesting. So ready to run is a pre-compilation. It's a pre-compilation technology. So it sounds very similar to AOT, and in fact, it is. You know, it's AOT in the sense it's ahead of time. You run it during build time when your code hasn't been run yet, as opposed to jitting at runtime. And the reason for that is that jitting has some performance implications that may not be desirable. In particular, it can come with startup costs. Because you are jitting at runtime, because you're compiling at runtime, that basically means that it's your code's performance plus it's the performance of the jit. That is, there's overhead of doing the compilation at runtime. And sometimes that's a good thing because the jit has a lot of information at runtime, and sometimes that can help it generate really, really good code. but sometimes it's a bad thing, like for startup, where you want your application to start up quickly. And if it's jitting all the time at runtime, then it's not going to start up that quickly. So ready to run is a basically a pre-jit mechanism. And in fact, it is a pre-jit mechanism. It just runs the jit ahead of time. And the goal is to save some of the runtime jitting so that you can start your app quicker and you have less jitting at runtime.
I remember at some point, I don't know, was it .NET 5 or earlier, that there was an introduction of multiple levels of jitting or multiple layers of jitting.
Yeah.
I don't quite know what the question to ask. Thank you. That's what I want to ask you about.
Yeah. So historically, .NET has only really had one level of tiering. That is only one level of compilation. Something was either compiled or it wasn't compiled. And when you jitted something, you jitted it once and then you were done. There's good reasons to try and do more or less of that. So in contrast, I'll pick Java. So Java, its strategy was to go from multiple levels, multiple tiers of jitting. So the first tier would be interpreter, and it wouldn't have the highest throughput for any particular piece of code. But the idea is that the cost of interpreting in terms of immediate cost or startup cost would be somewhat low. And then you get C1, which is the second tier, and it's effectively a JIT, but the trade-off is heavily in favor of lower time to JIT and not so great code gen. And then the last tier, which they call C2, is a long time. This can take a long time to compile your method, but it should provide the best possible performance. And they use a variety of different optimization techniques and profiling to try and tune those things in as your application executes. So the hottest methods, things that are executed the most, go to C2 and get the best code gen, while the things that are barely executed, maybe they stay interpreted or they only go to C1. This is a really valuable technique. And so it's something we've started exploring more in .NET. The penalty is kind of what you think. If you hear about this, it's somewhat complicated. And so it can produce variable performance in certain circumstances. You know, you maybe run an application, you call a few methods, and the first five times they're kind of slow, and then suddenly they get very fast. And sometimes, you know, something never really makes it to C2 or the highest level of compilation. But when it works, it's very effective. Like it's very fast and you get a good trade-off all the way through.
With ready to run, is it architecture dependent? So am I saying this is for my x86-64, this is for my whatever else?
Yeah. So ready to run is actually jitting at compile time. So it's architecture dependent. So it depends on both the operating system and the machine processor. And it will actually run the JIT. And so it includes JIT targets when the CrossGen tool itself, CrossGen is the tool that does ready to run. The CrossGen tool itself contains JIT targets for all the architectures and operating systems that CoreCLR supports so that it can emit actual native code into the binary. And if you look at the binary, you look at what an R2R binary looks like. So if you take a regular .NET conventional binary, it contains .NET IL, but it doesn't contain native code. An R2R binary is actually a hodgepodge. It contains a section of native code and it contains a section of IL. And that section of native code is pre-compiled methods for the IL bodies in the managed part.
Why is it split between IL and fully pre-compiled?
So that's what R2R doesn't do, which is fully pre-compile.
I see.
So the difference is, the main difference between native AOT and R2R, which we've had and will always have, huge part of our general compilation strategy for .NET. Native AOT says, let's never do the jitting portion. In fact, let's not even have a JIT. It's only pre-compilation. And there are a lot of benefits and there are a lot of penalties that come from that compilation model. But we saw some of the new and evolving circumstances for various application types. And we thought, okay, native AOT actually makes sense for a class of applications, and we'd like to enable those applications. And so some of the biggest benefits, as you would guess, are our startup time. And then also the binaries can be smaller, but that's actually a very complicated topic.
Before we move on to that one, with ready to run, do you end up with a larger package to deploy than you would if you were, okay, sorry, go ahead.
Always, yeah. Yes, because you never throw out any of the managed code. So one of the interesting things is that R2R's model is dependent upon a JIT being available. And there are some very tricky things about how .NET works, where sometimes the compilation model will require you, or actually the execution model will require you to fall back to a JIT, that it's not always possible to pre-compile everything. And so you will always get all of the managed code and additional native code. So your binaries will always be larger, sometimes substantially.
And then trimming, that I think came out around the same time as Ready to Run.
A little bit later. So okay. Ready to Run actually came out, Ready to Run as we currently know it came out around trimming. But Ready to Run is actually an evolution of a technology that we've had in .NET since 1.0. It used to be called NGen or Native Generation on Windows, and it shipped with the original .NET framework simply because startup. We've always, in the same way that I described that Java had this balance where they would go from interpretation to C2, and they would fall back to interpretation for improved startup performance. .NET has kind of taken a different evolutionary track. We've instead tried to move the compilation outside of the runtime pipeline. So we've preferred to use technologies to do ahead of time compilation to improve startup performance rather than fiddling with the different levels of runtime generation. We're adding more stuff now, but it's mostly about hitting all of the different targets.
So then trimming, where does that come into the story?
Yeah, so trimming is a completely different approach. It's kind of one of the things that came around with .NET Core that we didn't have with .NET Desktop is this application model where you compile things as self-contained binaries. So with .NET Core, we have an entire framework, and that framework can be bundled with the application and shipped on a user machine. And with self-contained applications, we can take your binary, all your dependencies, the whole framework, the whole runtime, and ship it all together in one bundle. The problem with this is that bundle can be pretty darn large. So how do we get around that? The idea is trimming. And so one of the technologies that we have is IL trimming. And the idea for that is, what if we can analyze the self-contained bundle, figure out all the stuff that's used, and then trim away all the unused stuff, so you're left with a smaller application at the end.
And is that, I know that, you know, there are certain limitations on the AOT that we're going to talk about in a second, but are there any concerns or worries around trimming things out of binaries yeah. that you've downloaded from NuGet and all over the place?
Yeah, so the tricky bit, so it sounds like a really simple concept. We get rid of the unused stuff, we keep the used stuff. The problem with doing this with .NET, and especially with .NET code that's been written for, you know, dozens of years, that expecting this kind of dynamic JITted object model, is that finding out what's used and what's unused can be really, really complicated. The most important example is something like assembly loading. So it's been pretty natural for the past 20 years that if you want to load an assembly, you can call this API called assembly.load, and you can load any .NET IL as a plugin into your application. But if you think about it, the self-contained application probably doesn't see that plugin when it's being built. And therefore, if you call assembly.load for a trimmed application, the plugin has no idea what your app uses or doesn't use, especially from the .NET framework itself. So it wouldn't know what's going to be preserved in your self-contained app. And the self-contained app doesn't know what's going to be used by the plugin. So effectively, you've kind of broken the guarantee that you have to be able to see the whole application in order to trim. And plugin loading isn't compatible because you can't see the whole application. But even accepting plugins, which are kind of the biggest granularity here, reflection can kind of produce the same effect. Sometimes it's fine. One of the big misconceptions about trimming is that reflection isn't possible. Reflection is possible, but it has to be able to be statically understood by the trimming technology. And that means that it has to conform to certain requirements. And I can get into detail on that. But then there are some aspects of reflection where, you know, clearly it will never be understood. So my go-to example is that if you do console.readline and ask the user to type in a type name and then do type.getType that type name, well, the user could type anything in. How could the trimmer possibly know what the user is going to type in? They can't. So the only recourse here would be to keep everything in the application, which means just turning trimming off. So that's not good. So the solution is this technology that we built that does static analysis, and it tries to produce warnings every time that it finds, oh, here's a place where you're going to do something where I can't quite figure out what you're going to depend on. It's possible that this works, but it's, you know, either improbable or at least shady. And so the whole trimming story is actually that the static analysis is going to find the things that it needs to keep, or it's going to warn to you, I don't know what this is going to use. You need to either replace this functionality entirely or try to annotate the code to tell me what it's going to use.
Do certain types of serialization use reflection?
Yeah, so certain types, probably all of them.
But I'm thinking the source generated may not now.
The vast majority of them. So there are two source generators that I know of that effectively source generation gets away, tries to get away from this problem. Yeah. So there's a source generated version of system.text.json inside the framework that is trimming compatible. So that tries to avoid the problem. And then I have a personal project, which is a port of Rust's serialization framework called SERDE, S-E-R-D-E. And that's just my personal attempt to generate a source-generated serialization, deserialization framework.
If I'm right, to make it clear, with the system.txt.json, you have a choice to go with source generation or not.
That's correct.
Even if you're using it, you may still, if you're not going with source generation, you could hit this problem as you're talking about. I just want to warn listeners of that.
Yes, explicitly, there is a change you'll have to make, which is there's a source system.txt.json with source generation, and you have to use that one. The good news is that you'll actually know if this is a problem, because if you trim and the build output produces warnings, that should be the situation of which, like, it should tell you every single place in your application which is problematic.
Would tools like AutoMapper be affected too? Because I think in the initial run through of setting up the mapping between person and student or whatever, I believe there's reflection that occurs at the outset.
Right. So reflection is this kind of thing where it's kind of spread all over Tons of libraries use it. It's often the base of things. It's very difficult to actually know. One of the key insights here is it's very difficult to know as a programmer whether or not something's safe. I personally don't trust myself to necessarily know whether something's safe, but the static analysis of trimming is like the saving grace, that if I can actually find a way to get rid of the problem and make the trimmer happy that there's no more warning, that's effectively the only way I know how to deal with these things. There have been actually multiple instances where we've suppressed a warning inside the .NET framework because, in our infinite wisdom, we believed as .NET engineers that knew what we were doing and that we knew that this thing was always going to be trim safe, and we were wrong. Sometimes it's as simple as, well, you suppress it now because it's safe now, but then you change the application later and it's not safe, but that suppression's still there. So it's a very shady, shady business.
All of this background brings us now, let's say, up to ahead of time compilation. So what was the history of moving from Raytheon, trimming, all these other tools to AOT?
Yeah, so AOT is kind of the combination of everything. So the starting point is there are a couple application types or app model types which are particularly well suited for native AOT. In particular, there are things that require really fast startup, things that run for a short period of time. Those things often need really fast startup. Also, sometimes there are things that just need a very small file size. Well, AOT, if you go back and you actually think AOT is going to generate native code, it's not entirely clear why AOT would produce smaller files. I already said that if you create a self-contained runtime and you don't trim, it's really large. And in fact, that's true for AOT as well. It's in fact actually much, much worse. .NET IL tends to be a very compact format and it can represent a lot in a very short amount of space. Machine code is not as compact. And so you can often take a self-contained application that's, let's say, 100 megabytes, and it's kind of hard to get below that because the .NET framework itself is something like 60 or 80 megabytes without trimming. And if you run that through native compilation, you could easily see blowups of 5x or 10x. So you can end up with easily a gigabyte binary if you pull in, another 100 megabytes of extra pieces. So the key thing here is trimming is a part of native AOT as well, that you need native AOT to be trimmed in order to produce binaries that are actually acceptable. And if you do that, then it turns out to be an extremely effective thing because you can remove not just the managed pieces, the IL, but you can also start removing pieces of the runtime itself. That if your runtime doesn't need XYZ feature, then it will get trimmed away as well. And so the final application can be even smaller when you go with native AOT than it would be even if you do trimming.
When you, I suppose, decided to go to the next step with AOT, was it a business push, or was it a technology, a natural evolution? What brought you to this?
So we've been experimenting in a lot of different ways, a lot of different places. There's a technology called .NET Native that was built for Windows Store apps and is still around, but it was kind of purpose built for that technology, and it doesn't really have it didn't have a lot of growth potential outside of that area. Native AOT is kind of our rethinking and trying to actually solve some of those problems that we ran into with .NET Native and think, how would we do this if we wanted to expand? And yeah, the impetus mainly came from people saying, you have this technology, or you've experimented with the technology. I have this need for fast startup for small binaries, or even actually one of the biggest ones was I have a need for not jitting. Jitting does require certain technologies, one of which is marking operating system pages as read and write so that you can write code and then, or sorry, write and execute so that you can write code and then execute it immediately after you write it. And there are certain platforms where that's not allowed, mostly because some malware does the same thing for completely different reasons. So they ban that technology, write and execute pages entirely. And native AOT is kind of, well, it's one answer to that kind of platform requirement.
What about for things like embedded systems or Internet of Things, where you might not want to use a lot of battery power with jitting?
Yes, right. The overhead there can also be important. Sometimes jitting is just, it's going to take more resources and you don't want to consume those resources. In many ways, the JIT code or the work that JIT does is often thrown out, and it has to be redone at every launch of the process. So ahead of time compilation can really save in terms of overall impact.
If you were to compare, let's say, where we were with .NET 6 with ready-to-run trimming and now with .NET 7 with AOT, what would you say the difference is, or the benefit perhaps?
Yeah, I think that it forms this spectrum that we think about form factors on the .NET team. And in fact, one of the partner architects for the .NET runtime wrote this form factors document for .NET. And it explores this idea that there are certain kind of application types or environments where one thing fits best and another thing is just not going to work. And that kind of holds true for any technology you can think of. There are some places where AOT, like maybe small, fast, constrained devices, where AOT is kind of your only option. But then there are other systems like plug and load, where jitting is actually your only option. So we think of it as a spectrum, and we want to let customers decide what's the right balance for them.
From the perspective of, let's say, the work you and your team had to do, was this significant compared to, let's say, what you had with .NET 6?
So there was an experiment that we've been running for a long time now, actually. So the native AOT code was preceded by this thing called CoreRT, which was an experimental version of how can we think about .NET Native and kind of expand, make it more maintainable, that is, make it more like CoreCLR, share more with CoreCLR, reuse a lot of the technologies and the ideas that we've come up with before. And that had been floating around for a bit. So that was a ton of work to build that. And I actually was, CoreRT was started quite a long time ago, more than 5 years ago. So I wasn't around when it started, but a huge amount of work went into that. And then we still had a significant amount of work to kind of modernize CoreRT, meet the guarantees that we feel like need to be met in order to make it usable for people, and then launch it and make it a supported way, basically integrate it into .NET runtime in a way where it's truly a form factor of .NET. That is, it's an alternate form of CoreCLR, but it's not its own thing where you have to kind of expect differences all over the place.
Actually, I remember CoreRT seeing a part of a presentation at a conference about it. But then when I mentioned it to colleagues, no one had heard of it. And I don't think I ever made use of it, but I remember it was Mark Rendell in the UK, and he was saying how much faster it was for some application he had written. I was kind of, oh, look at that. But then I don't know, was it not very well promoted, or didn't catch on in some way?
So to a certain extent, I think that, you know, promotion for these things can be difficult.
Yeah.
In general, I don't blame people for not adopting CoreRT. It was experimental, so I don't expect a lot of people to adopt our experiments. And we did get valuable feedback from it, or we got valuable feedback as an experiment. The native AOT is significantly, it's effectively the core RT code just integrated into the .NET runtime proper. So I would say that from a product perspective, it was a success because we decided that we got enough feedback and enough positive feedback in particular that we would make it a fully supported version, a form factor of .NET.
For someone listening to the podcast, maybe they've heard AOT being mentioned. What would you say are some of the good use cases for it and some of the bad use cases for it?
Yeah, so in .NET 7, we were starting a little bit slow because, as I mentioned with the limitations aspect, it's a pretty different way of programming. It's certainly the case that a lot of libraries and a lot of application or a lot of APIs that you might be used to using aren't compatible with the form factor. So there are some significant limitations, and we've been doing an absolute ton of work to try and build up the base libraries so that they are either completely trim compatible and AOT compatible, or they kind of declare at their API boundary, like, hey, I'm not trim compatible. You need to find something else to use if you want to use it in AOT. So right now, console applications is what we're supporting for .NET 7, along with native libraries. Native libraries is this concept of like, what if you want to build like a .so or like a .a, something that could be consumed by C++ and actually linked as a native binary. In this case, native AOT would be that. We can compile the whole .NET runtime and all of its dependencies into a self-contained native asset that could be integrated into your existing native pipeline.
Where does the limitation of console apps, I'm looking at the native AOT page, and the quote is, it is currently not supported with ASP.NET Core, but only console apps. Where does, yeah. Is that the trimming issue? Is it?
Right. So it's, so if the, is your question basically, you know, why not ASP.NET yet?
Yeah.
Why yeah. Not? So it's trimming basically. There are two things. I already mentioned trimming and in many ways that's the big one. I think most people are probably going to run into trimming problems with some of their dependencies and probably even with some of the libraries that they own. AOT also has an extra limitation that I didn't mention before, which is that the code needs to be specifically AOT compatible. And what that means is that there are a few APIs in .NET like make generic type or make generic method. And those APIs do runtime code generation. And because we don't have a JIT in AOT, those kind of APIs are off limits. So in addition to the trimming, it's also, okay, you can't use make generic method, you can't use make generic type, you have to find some other way to kind of do your, you can't use refemit, you know, you have to find some other way to do those things. Usually our answer is, you know, source generation. Source generation is the part and parcel, like, okay, this thing is the thing that can work everywhere. And yeah, ASP.NET, not as much problems in general, not as many problems with make generic method, although there are some exceptions like EF, entity framework, they use a lot of that, but it's often trimming. So in the case of ASP.NET, we're doing a lot of work to try and make it trim compatible.
Can I build my own libraries and compile them to AOT to use in my AOT console applications?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So the frame console application is kind of a coarse one. We didn't have a short, pithy way to explain to people the limitations. The concrete limitation here is actually, if you don't get trim warnings, then you are perfectly fine. Doesn't matter what type of application you're writing, if you don't have any trim warnings, then you can effectively see that as a guarantee from the compiler that your application will have exactly the same behavior after trimming, after AOT, as it did before. Most of the time, that's console applications because the APIs that console applications use are pretty much the only ones that we've managed to finish making trim compatible and AOT compatible at the moment. but in theory, it could be anything. And then if you do have trim warnings, that's where the danger comes in. And effectively, even one trim warning can mean that your application might either change behavior or crash or basically do anything. We just can't know. The whole problem with the trim warnings is they're warnings of the compiler doesn't really know what's going on here. It could be scary.
If I am an open source developer and I've got a NuGet package up there, do I now need to have an AOT version of the package along with a non-AOT version of the package?
We'd like for, I think that the ideal place is actually that there would be one version of the package which is AOT compatible. It's possible that you're writing some sort of library that just will never be AOT compatible due to kind of, maybe it's completely plugin dependent and you explicitly want to support the scenario of loading plugins at run or on the user's machine, you know, sometime out of control of the application build. That's tough. You probably just need to tell your customers, hey, I'm never going to work in an AOT scenario. But for most customers, it would be nice if we could get a lot of their libraries to be trim compatible and AOT compatible. And we have a doc on docs.microsoft.com called Prepare Your Libraries for Trimming that kind of walks you through, here's what the trim warnings are, here's kind of what they're telling you, and here's how to resolve them. And in many cases, especially with reflection, I mentioned earlier, reflection actually is okay. You can use reflection, and that's true. It's just that the reflection needs to be annotated to say, an example is effectively, you take as a parameter to your method some system.type, some instance of system.type, and then you're going to do reflection on that system.type saying type.get methods, something like that. The problem is that from the compiler's perspective, that system.type could be anything, and therefore the system doesn't know to keep methods on all of the system.types that flow into that call. So the annotation that we would request would be people place this new attribute that we have, dynamically access members, onto that parameter of their method saying, keep all methods. And then when somebody calls that function, the compiler can know, oh, I need to keep all methods on the system.type that came in here. And then at runtime, that AOT or trimming scenario would work just fine because it kept all the things that it needs, and also the warning would go away. So the nice thing is also, you know, you solve the warning and you solve the problem at the same time.
So you've touched on, I guess, what I was going to ask you next, the steps that need to be taken both, let's say, within Microsoft and outside for AOT to be more broadly adopted. You mentioned that there's documentation available for, let's say, NuGet package maintainers. But what about within Microsoft? What's the, let's say, the schedule or the timeline for making ASP.NET and Web API and Entity Framework?
Absolutely. So ASP.NET is planned for .NET 8. That's where we're setting an aggressive schedule. And we're going to try and make large portions of ASP.NET, not everything, but large portions trim compatible for .NET 8. Especially, we're going to create a minimal API and web templates that people are familiar with that are fully trim compatible and can be used in native AOT. Other sections, you know, as the .NET team, we're actually a small portion of the total amount of .NET code written at Microsoft. So it's more of a conversation. Our relationship with other teams at Microsoft is actually not so different from our relationship with arbitrary people on GitHub or on NuGet. We provide resources, we explain kind of what you need to do, and we're there for questions, but we're not necessarily going and making arbitrary code trim compatible. It's more of a request on the library owners.
Do you think JIT and IL is going to go away in any sense?
So the kind of the opposite. JIT and IL are the way that we've been developing and building .NET for, you know, 20 years now. they probably are going to be the predominant way that people use .NET for the next 20. Native AOT is really attractive and interesting to a certain set of customers with a certain set of requirements, but the features and the performance and everything is so well understood, and the trade-offs are so well understood for conventional .NET development that I think a lot of people will decide to stick with that. And I think that's a very appropriate response, actually.
Actually, I'll bring up a use case that I'm seeing. I mean, I work at AWS. I write a lot about Lambda functions. They're the serverless functions. And I've seen significantly better performance by compiling to native AOT with .NET 7 because of the cold start. So for people who don't know, the cold start is the first time you invoke your function, an execution environment has to be created, your code is downloaded, initialization code is run, jitting is done, and that can take a little bit of time. But with native AOT, that is significantly faster. That does seem to be a very good case. But before we started recording, you had said to me that there was a flaw in my thinking. So
yeah, so no, I think that your thinking is basically right, that's completely correct, that AWS Lambda and those kinds of applications are really focused on startup performance. And also sometimes the actual runtime of the application is pretty low. So the startup performance might actually be a significant portion of the total runtime. And for AOT, if you can take the startup performance and take it from 200 milliseconds, 400 milliseconds, whatever it is, and turn it into 50 milliseconds, that can represent a huge performance increase and also like lower budget. You know, it's a great opportunity for a lot of people. The only problem is that, you know, the limitations of AOT make it somewhat restrictive, and you have to think about both what your application is doing, but also what all of your dependencies are doing. And so in particular, I think I read the .NET blog post for AWS with native AOT, and I was super happy to see it. And actually, we've been working with some AWS engineers, and it's been really productive. Actually, as an open source product and open source community, it's been a great experience. But I do know that AWS actually has some pieces of the SDK which are not trimmable yet. So there's just one of those other things of, yep, everybody kind of needs to go and rev their application in order to deal with the limitations.
But there is a file that we put in exclusions into. So when you get the Lambda template, the project template, it has, I think, an rd.xml or something like that. And
Right. And that is actually unsupported. It actually is the exact problem where it's not clear. The compiler can't tell if that actually worked. One of the trickiest bits about trimming is actually that people generally think, oh, well, the way I'll get away from the trimming is I'll take the incompatible piece of code and I won't trim it. And that's actually the exact opposite of the problem with trimming, because the problem with trimming isn't that there is some incompatible piece of code and the goal is to not trim that piece of code. The problem is that there's some incompatible piece of code that might be run against other code in the framework, and the other code is the thing that's going to be trimmed. So with serializers, the problem is, to use an example, the XML serializer in .NET is not trim compatible. If you say to the trimmer, hey, don't trim XML serializer, well, XML serializer, the problem with trimming isn't that XML serializer itself might be trimmed away. The problem is that when you use it against some other piece of code in your application, that piece might be trimmed away. And there's no way to know what XML serializer is going to run against. So you just have no way of knowing what you need to keep, what you need to preserve. Like, and that can change on an hour-to-hour basis as people start to serialize or deserialize arbitrary things. And it's even worse because sometimes stuff will be trimmed away, but there's no real way to notice. So think about the scenario where you serialize to a network connection and some of it is trimmed away. You might not notice. What happens is just that pieces of the data type that you're serializing gets trimmed away. And so your message payload is just secretly smaller. It's just missing fields. And maybe you don't have good logging on the other side to know, hey, I'm not getting everything that I'm supposed to. And so now this gets saved into your database. 6 months later, you're like, oh no, I have data corruption for the last 6 months and I never knew about it. So it's just very dangerous. It's not always an exception. It's not always a crash. Sometimes just subtle behavior changes can be really disastrous.
Yeah, gotcha. And then these would be, as you say, runtime. You wouldn't even get necessarily an exception. You might not get a runtime. Would you get a runtime exception, or would it simply be, in the case of the serialization, the absence of information?
Yeah, it just sometimes it's just absence of information.
Yeah.
You don't know. Sometimes the real trick is, like, sometimes with trimming, you remove items and then those items really were needed, and then you get an exception when something tries to access those items. But sometimes your code just never really does something with those items that would cause an exception, and things just move along transparently. Like, get methods, maybe it returns null. Maybe you never notice that it returns null. Oh, that's a problem.
This kind of reminds me of when async was introduced. You know, if you started async, you had to have async all the way down. And now it kind of sounds like if you want to use AOT, you need trimming compatibility for the thing you use and the thing it uses and the thing that it uses and so on.
Yep. Yeah, AOT compatibility. So AOT is a technology that works on the whole application. So whether or not something's trimmable is actually a question for the whole application, which means every single bit of code that's being used in your app needs to be trimmable in order for the whole thing to work properly.
If a person wants to start using native AOT now, you know, they understand the limitations. How do they get going?
Yeah, so we have some documentation on docs.microsoft for how to use the feature. At the very simplest level, there's a property called publish AOT. And if you set it to true in your project file and then run .NET publish, that's it. Your application is now being published with native AOT. And if you get no trim warnings, that's it as well. Like, we promise that your application will do the exact same thing it did before, or, you know, it's a bug on our side, right? But if you get warnings, that's more of a problem. And then you have to either fix them if they're in your application, and we do have docs on how to fix them. We would encourage people to, you know, go talk to the maintainers of your favorite libraries and say, you know, this thing isn't trim compatible. I want to use it in a trim scenario. Honestly, I've seen some libraries where there is not that much work to be done and that it can be made trimmable. Or actually, in a different way of thinking about it, sometimes certain parts of the library aren't trimmable, but maybe you aren't using those parts, and the parts that you are using are pretty easily made trimmable. So it's kind of a different, depends on exactly what you're using, and it's more individual.
What if a person said to you, you know what, I love AOT, but I don't want to bother with the trimming. Can I turn it off and get a really big binary that is AOT compiled, please?
Really big could mean like a gigabyte. And to be honest, the technologies, the compiler and stuff, aren't really robust against those kinds of sizes. So you could try, but it would be pretty darn scary. I suspect that if you're emitting a 1 gigabyte binary, and we have to keep metadata inside memory for the 1 gigabyte binary, and you think, oh, maybe we need to keep 5 megabytes of metadata for every 1 megabyte of emitted output, you're talking about like a 5 gigabyte memory consumption. And that's on the low end. You know, what if that needs to blow up to 20 threads? Now we're 20 gigabytes of memory. It would probably be not tractable.
All right, a non-starter. What, though, is the future for AOT over the next few years?
Yeah, so I think the main future is that we've been moving in the framework itself to become more trim compatible, more AOT compatible. With ASP.NET, we're moving huge portions of the most popular, most commonly used libraries over. And I've seen some big third-party or customer libraries that have also become more trim compatible. The hope is that we can develop a large functional set of libraries and applications that all have trim compatibility. And then the question really becomes for you, what's the right trade-off of performance for your application? Is AOT, do you want the startup performance, or would you, let's say, maybe want to go with CoreCLR where it doesn't have the best startup performance, but actually Jitting can in some cases use runtime information to be really, really fast. And you could theoretically see some better end state throughput with dynamic recompilation than you would with native AOT.
That's the end of part one of my chat with Andy Gokey. In part two, he'll answer some listener questions. If you like this episode, you might also like the other episodes on C#. There's a link in the show notes. The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Beautiful Nights by Ketsa.